When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I want to welcome everyone to episode number 25 of Matt Memories from Madison Square Garden, a 50-year retrospective, the early years of the WWWF, the WWF, and the WWE. Madison Square Garden, the mecca of professional wrestling, a building that every wrestler wanted to wrestle in. We record one show a month to coincide with the 50th anniversary of a wrestling house show at Madison Square Garden. And to help us look back at all these shows, a man who went to every wrestling house show at Madison Square Garden for 5 years straight, starting on August 30th, 1971, Mr. Wrestling himself, John Arizzi. John, how are you?
Good. I was as crazy back then as I am now. Attending every show over 5 years.
Over a five-year period. Yeah, you know, yeah. And let's think about that first. That's an amazing run because, first of all, you were young, very young at the time. What were you? You just turning 14 when you started?
I went when I was 14 years old in August of 71.
I was just talking with my buddies, and we were talking about growing up on Long Island and going into the city. It was very rare that we went to the city. You know, we had the Nassau Coliseum at the time, so we didn't really go into the city for a lot of things, even for concerts. They play the Garden, and then they play the Coliseum. So when we did go into the city, it was something. You, being even younger than we were, going into the city on the train by yourself every month, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I was, and my mom was always a worrier, didn't ever want me to leave the house. Matter of fact, I had gotten a mini bike.
You got a mini bike?
One Christmas. Yeah. I had pestered my dad, and on Christmas Eve, he surprised me and took me into the mini bike store, and I got a mini bike for Christmas. And like an idiot, you know, I took it in the basement, and I started it up, of course, inside, first and foremost, and that wasn't pleasing.
You were inside with a mini bike? What are you doing?
Yes, with the fumes. And, you know, they heard it start up, and they're like, what are you, crazy? Because it was winter, obviously, but I was the only one. Because two of my other friends had gotten mini bikes too that Christmas, and they're riding it around, you know, the little town, and it's illegal, whatever. But my mom wouldn't let me leave the property with the mini bike. You know, when the weather got warmer, I rode it in the backyard, and I rode around the house over and over again with a little trench.
How big was your backyard?
We had 100 by 100 square foot property.
Oh, gosh, that's nothing. You must have always like made like a hole out of the track.
Oh, yeah. If she warned me, don't you take this outside the gate? A couple of times I did that. But for the most part, I was landlocked. So, her letting me go into the city.
Huge.
At 14.
Yeah.
Every month. It wasn't easy for her.
No, that's a huge thing. Because you weren't like, I would think it's easier to get to some of the smaller towns, even easier to get to like the Boston Garden than that. You have to take the LIRR, and it was like an hour ride, wasn't it?
It was at least an hour. And it was always off peak. So you try to get that off peak express, which only made a couple of stops instead of that whole Long Island Railroad. You know, you lived on Long Island, but I knew
every
the
stop
train line.
Babylon, next stop, Babylon.
Yeah, it was like Penn Station. It'll be Woodside, Jamaica, Lynbrook, Rockville Center, Belmore, Seaford, Massapequa Park, Amityville, Copaig, Lindenhurst, and Babylon. Change at Babylon for the train to Ronkonkoma.
It's so funny because a couple of years ago, I went back to New York and I was staying in the city. I realized when I got there, I'd never stayed in the city. I stayed in the city before, but I'd never actually flown in and had to take the train there. So I had to, there's a shuttle that goes from JFK to Jamaica, and you get on the train to Jamaica, and you take it in the city, then you get on the subway. It just,
I had it easy with the Long Island Railroad. It would go right into Penn, go upstairs, go to the show, and, you know, out of high school, I would, you know, we get out at 2 o'clock, run home, change your clothes, get your camera, and then go first. What we used to do with my friend Frank and I, we'd go to the newsstands and make sure that we got all of our wrestling magazines. You know, every month there were like 10 or 12 different wrestling magazines.
What?
So you'd load up on the wrestling magazines.
So you did this in New York? Is that where you were?
Where we used to, because there were a couple of newsstands that were like these massive newsstands that would have all the wrestling titles, you know, all the books, all the magazines, and we would do that. And sometimes it would be a little too much because you'd have like 8 magazines in your lap or in a bag or whatever. But we had to do it. It was coming home. That's why that 11 p.m. curfew was so critical, to make sure you got that 11:10 train. And then you'd have to wait an hour, and then you wouldn't get home till after 1 a.m. And so it was a challenge. But I was young, as a kid. It was like my monthly sabbatical. I mean, I couldn't miss it. God forbid I would have missed one of the shows back then.
I don't even know how you survived this long, because I can just see you running in your house, grabbing your camera, changing your clothes, running out real quick, making down to the train. You got to make it on time. Because if you miss that train, when do you get in next? You could be late for the show. And then finally, when you get on the train, all right, I'm on the train.
And look at it this way. When I started getting integrated in the business, like after I got my press pass, and here we are like in 75, and you know, I'm 17, just about to turn 18. And then it was kind of like you're hanging out at the bar afterwards. You would leave the Garden Show and I'd go right to the Savoy Bar, which was across from the Edison Hotel on 46th Street. And that's where the wrestlers hung out after the show. Those turned into late nights, because the bars are open till 4 a.m.
And you don't want to leave because something great's going to happen.
Yeah, you don't want to leave. I mean, you get in there and, you know, you get there and the first person you always saw was Captain Lou Albano. He was always the first one at the bar and the last one to leave. But then, you know, Bruno Sammartino would come in and, you know, there's Andre the Giant. And here's all, you know, it was a bar that only held 100 people, 150. It was a small little dive bar.
Did you ever leave early and then you find out later on something really cool happened?
Not to anything I remember, no. No, but it was like it was challenging, and I was a kid, you know. And then the other challenge was, that's where the streak stopped. Once I started going to college, then I had to make a decision. I couldn't go to New York for every girl. I couldn't go.
What is that from?
I started college in 75, September 75. I went to Graham Junior College. So for the first I would make that trek and try to get home for the weekend and miss a day of college and then head back on either the night after the show and take a Greyhound bus back to Boston. And then I finally was like, this is crazy. So I just stopped going every show.
Well, how long was that ride? Now, if you don't know Boston, you know, so you got, if you're in New York, then you have to go through this great state of Connecticut and then Rhode Island, and then Boston.
At least 4 to 5 hours.
Each way.
Yeah.
Yeah, you are crazy. That's a long ride. Because you did have this little place up there called the Boston Garden, and that's where you could go
see
shows.
I went to those shows, too, because those were typically all weekend shows, and a lot of them were like matinees. They'd wrestle on a Saturday afternoon.
Did you ever do a double 1 month where you got to go to the Boston Garden and then the Monday night go to the Madison Square Garden?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Ooh, that's a lot.
There was Philadelphia.
You did Philly, then, too?
Yeah, well, the Philly TV tapings were every 3 weeks, and I'd go to the Philly TV tapings because they taped 3 shows, and I did that really, literally, and my first show in Philly was, I believe it was in January of 75, and I went with George Napolitano. I mean, I drive with him.
So you would be in Boston. When would the tapings be? What day of the week?
They're on a Tuesday.
So you'd be in Boston. You'd leave either Monday night or Tuesday morning, take a train or a bus down to New York, meet George, jump in George's car, drive another 2.5 to 3 hours to Philadelphia, watch the TV tapings. When do they usually start?
Jeez, 6, 7 o'clock. It's probably 7 o'clock. And then we typically sleep, or we'd go to Hamburg. Hamburg was Wednesday because Championship Wrestling was taped at the Philadelphia Arena on 45th and Market Tuesday nights every 3 weeks. And then you'd go to Hamburg, PA, where they would tape at the Field House, and that was All-Star Wrestling. That was the Joe McHugh ring announcer, and the night before was Buddy Wagner, typically, and then Gary Michael Capetta took over for him. But there were many times that I did that, many, many times. I mean, once I started getting a taste of the TV tapings, and that's where I took a lot of pictures. I mean, it wasn't like every single show, especially when I went to college. I remember the last TV taping I attended was when I wrestled.
What? Okay, so you started.
I wrestled in January 10th, 78. So we're Philadelphia TV.
That's 3 years. You were doing that for 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, summer times were easier. That year in 75, it was every 3 weeks until I started college, and I couldn't do it all the time.
Yeah.
But certainly there were winter breaks, there was spring break, there was summer break, so you'd get plenty of shows.
I was going to say, how did you even pass college? Because it's not, they're not close. They're four different states.
Yeah,
four or five different states away. What are we talking? You're talking in, you're in Boston, then you got to go through Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York. Yeah. New Jersey, and then you're down to Pennsylvania. That's five states. You get into five states, and then you got to get back to college. Yeah.
Imagine going after I wrestled that night on January 10th, 78, and I got concussed by Dusty, and I wrestled, you know, the strongbow match, you know, and I wound up taking the train from Philly back to Boston after I wrestled all night long to get back to college.
Oh. Well, I like the idea of getting on one train, because I'm thinking buses, because you said you had to take a bus sometimes from Boston to New York.
Yeah, a bus was a nonstop. I mean, but you could stop in Hartford to pick people up. You could make several stops along the route.
But it's longer,
too. As a train did, too. Yeah, yeah. It was crazy. I was a teenager. And when I wrestled, I was only 20. I mean, I was 3 weeks shy of my 21st birthday.
Let me ask you, when you knew about, you know, you're going to get in this match, did you go, hey, I have an idea? Let me do a drop kick on you.
Yeah, that's I was scared shitless. I was absolutely out of my mind. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how to work a man. I didn't know how to do any of that. I didn't know how to do a body slam. I didn't know how to do anything. I was out of my mind. I was out of my mind.
You're lucky you just got a little concussed, because that it could have been I'm so
lucky.
Much worse.
I'm lucky. And after, you know, the first match, it was like they knew. And then, you know, the second match, I was in that tag team, and they wouldn't even let me in the ring till the finish, where I got thrown in the top rope and got, you know, headbutt by Maya Villa, and Strongbow pinned me. And the third taping of the night, I was supposed to go one-on-one with Bob Backlund. And that was at the end of the second, you know, Monsoon was like, all right, kid, you're done.
Oh, he saved you, John. He saved your life. Backlund would have stretched you.
Made that $90, man. Oh, it was $100. It was $100, but $10 was taken out for the license fee for the night.
Of course, of course. And we always say this: you did only wrestle two matches, but you wrestled three Hall of Famers.
Yes,
almost a fourth in one night. Yeah. That's a good night of wrestling. That's a good night of wrestling.
So. I would say so.
well, let's get it. We're gonna get into the tickets in a second. I just wanted to go over some of your other stuff going on since we talked. Your Blue Jay podcast. Well, the Blue Jays are not in the playoffs anymore. Let's just put it that way. So how is
we're
that
still
going?
Doing the show?
You're still doing the show with Gibby, the Gibby Show, right?
For now, yeah.
Yeah,
we're having, you know, now that the Jays disappointed the country of Canada by getting eliminated in the first round, getting swept, the podcast continues. We're covering what potential free agents could be on the Jays next year. Who should they go after, rather? Who, you know, because they have seven free agents of their own they could potentially lose this year. And Gibby's bringing on the guests. We had a Hall of Famer, Paul Molitor, on last week. I mean, what an amazing career he had. Ken Rosenthal comes on this week's show, which obviously when people hear this, you know, this is covering November. So the podcast is going to wind down most likely right after the World Series. And we may have an episode or two after the World Series, and then we shut it down and return next spring during spring training. Unless with the baseball winter meetings happening in Nashville this year, I'm trying to convince Gibby that maybe we should get, well, he can, you know, we can get credentialed easily because we might be able to do a couple of specials or like a week of shows during the baseball winter meetings. Ooh. It all depends on a lot of variables.
That would be nice. I like to hear that. So you got that going. And how about the Pro Wrestling Spotlight?
Pro Wrestling Spotlight, I mean, it really is kind of the beginning of the end on the run of the original Pro Wrestling Spotlight radio shows, which ran from 1989 to January of 95. And I was off the air for 8 months, November of 93 till August of 94. So now we're back covering the latter part of 94. So these are the last 12 shows. Then that runs its course. And I haven't decided whether or not to continue it to recycle these shows again and kind of put another spin on 89 to 95 again. So that's a big decision I have to make, whether I do monthly specials or whether I continue it. I don't know. All I know is like I'm listening to the 94 shows now as I'm uploading them. It was right after the ECW NWA screw job. And I was planning a wrestling convention, Weekend of Champions 5 at Farmingdale University. And I'm listening to it now because I knew there wasn't a Weekend of Champions 5.
Yeah, this is the first I've heard of it.
I knew there wasn't. I was promoting it on the show. Why didn't it happen? And I just listened to this show that we're uploading and we're going to talk about in about a week on the next podcast taping. And it was because ECW decided to run a show the very same night in Philadelphia using a lot of the guys I had booked for my convention and my live show.
Oh.
And I was going back and forth with Paul Heyman. All right, you could have Cactus or you could have Too Cold Scorpio, but I couldn't have, you know, all these other guys like Sabu and Matt Bourne, Doink the Clown, all these guys that I was going to bring to this Weekend of Champions 5. All of a sudden, Paulie has them working there. So, and when I returned, I noticed that there was crank callers because I finished up at GBB. Mm-hmm. And there were almost like 50% of the callers were cursing me, you know, saying, you know, you fat SOB, you know, just like prank callers. I had just come back on the air and I'm like, why am I even doing this?
Yeah.
This is the way people are reacting or treating me, or why am I even brokering a show and doing this and trying to promote again and getting screwed? I'm like, I'm kind of done. So it's going to be fascinating to hear the last 12 episodes because I had already been fed up during this last show that I just uploaded. I'm like, at the end of it too, it was like, maybe I'll be back next week.
Oh, wow. This is the first time I've heard of Weekend of Champions 5. And knowing Paul, like I did back in the day, I would never imagine him, you know, not being helpful to you whatsoever. So it's just funny that, like, he could have used you to save some money. He could have said, we're going to do it this night, you do it this night or this weekend, and you do it this time.
Right.
It could have changed. It could have saved you both some money in the whole thing and getting you on Long Island.
Yeah, I have to dive into it. I guess I'll discuss it more. All I know is that even for the next show that I'll be putting up there, I do miss a week because Herb Abrams ran the infamous pay-per-view in Vegas. So I flew out to Vegas to see that blackjack brawl rather than do a radio show. So, yeah, it's kind of an interesting – like I said, I say it all the time. Who really has the opportunity to go back in a time machine 30 years ago and listen to what you did every single week 30 years ago? And this podcast is even more crazy because I'm going back with you 50 years and it's freaking insane.
And if you want to hear any of the old podcasts or any of them, absolutely, you have to go check out our Patreon, patreon.com/John Arizzi. It's where we keep the lights on. It's what we, where all the archives can be found, where all the videos, well, I should
say. The lights are out.
Lights aren't out yet. We can watch. You can watch all. You can see the videos. You can get pictures. You get in the door for $5, and that's where you can live your wrestling dreams. Even when Pro Wrestling Spotlight, if John finishes up after 12, you'll still be able to go and listen to all the old episodes right there.
Of course.
On
Patreon. It's always there on Patreon, and they've made a new. There's a new site. Like Patreon is upgrading stuff. You could do different things. You could categorize stuff now, and that's something that it's going to make it more aesthetically pleasing once I dive into that, or hire somebody, or work with somebody to kind of fix it up. Because now, you know, with 200 plus radio shows, they should be easily accessible.
Yes.
Where it's like, all right, here's the category, radio shows, boom, and all the shows line up. Here are the photo sets. Boom. Here are the 8mm films. Boom. Instead of going back and scrolling over, you know, 600 posts, people can't find shit.
Yeah. Yeah. And now you just make it easier for people to find stuff. And I think it'd be really great for
the
Patreon.
So it's just a matter of time. And I can't, you know, technically, and, you know, I'm not a wizard, you know, so I'm definitely going to need some help with someone organizing the Patreon page for me. So I got to figure that out.
I'm looking forward to that. Well, you know, after Patreon, we come in tonight's show, and let's go into tonight's show because
let's go back 50 years, Tim. I'm sorry. We've been talking up a storm here today.
We have been, but I want to start off the show. Well, let me just say, let's start off with New York City. Let's go. I'm going to do the whole thing over again. I probably won't edit this out. All right, let's go back. To the matches 50 years ago today, New York City, Madison Square Garden, Monday night, November 12th, 1973, bell time, 8:30. Here's why I was getting a little caught up with myself, because I always ask about, well, first of all, the attendance was 16,148, and that is about 6,000 less attendance from last month's lackluster card. We have another 20-minute draw on this card, but what I wanted to get into, like I always say, hey, John, first of all, talk about the TV buildup to this, and then we have to talk about your tickets, because this is a big, big night for you and tickets. So let's talk about the TV buildup first.
It was a life-changing card for me. The TV buildup was what it always was. You know, it's you tape the TV, you do the promos, you're following up with a new challenger for Pedro Morales. So it's your typical buildup. There wasn't anything really special about it other than they promoted it for whatever reason. People didn't respond as much as they have done in the past, and that's why the attendance was only 16,148. Maybe Larry Henning wasn't seen as a credible challenger to Pedro Morales. That was that. It was a normal card, typical garden card, nothing really exciting with the exception of, you know, Andre was there, which we'll get into, and Vern Gagne was there, but that didn't mean anything to the fans in the long run anyway, because unless you read the national wrestling magazines, like the hardcore fans did, the casual fan didn't give a hoot about Vern Gagne, who he was, and that he was AWA champion. On the other side, when it came up to the tickets, I had talked to this guy I got to know, Mike Abrams, who was a photographer. I guess he did a little freelance work, but he always sold his pictures outside the garden or had an album of pictures that fans could buy from him. And he was always in the front row. So as I got to know Mike, I kept, you know, asking him, how did you get these tickets? How do you get these first row seats? Why are you in the first row like every month? And he finally said that there was a guy who worked at the box office. His name was Bill Baker, that you would go to him the day of the show and you would give him a tip on top of the $7 ringside price. That's all it was $7. And he would give you a good seat, a really good seat. So with me pestering him and, you know, being the gregarious person that I was, he got to like me. And then he offered to make that introduction for me. And I was scared because it's like, all right, you know, what if I get shut out? What if this doesn't work? And where do I sit? And because I don't have a ticket, what do I do? But anyway, that night, I was there with my friend Frank Favalli, as I always went with him in those early days. And sure enough, the box office was open, but there was this one window where Bill Baker opened up his little stanchion, whatever you call it, a little grate. You open it up. It's almost like you're opening up a store with like security on it. And then he gestured with his hand to come over. And so Mike went up there and he introduced me. This is my friend John, da 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 da. And I was like, all right, you know, here's $10, you know. And I got second row with my friend Frank. I got second row seats. And I was over the moon because here I was now sitting in the second row at Madison Square Garden. It was a monthly deal that started then, and it lasted throughout the entire year of 74 and into early 75 until I actually got a press pass and was at ringside shooting with George and Bill Apter and the rest of them. So that was exciting, and that was life-changing to me because now I could really take good pictures and I could really film very up close. But as time progressed, I concentrated much more on the still photos than the films.
I remember a couple of shows ago, you had that infamous corner shot that you all you had is the pole.
The ring post.
Ring post right there in front of you. So you'll never have that again.
Not a fan, no.
It did change your life because now you're taking more pictures, taking better pictures. And when did you, I remember you got in the magazines early on with a picture of a bloody Lou Albano. But yeah, when you started taking these kind of pictures, how long after you started getting these first and second row tickets did you sell any more pictures to the magazines? Do you remember?
1974, there was a magazine called The Big Book of Wrestling, an official wrestling guide published by a guy named Tommy Kay out in Scottsdale, Arizona. So at the time, I was running Blassie Fan Club, and I submitted a story on Freddie Blassie managing Nikolai Volkoff. Like Blassie leaves the ring, begins managing Volkoff. So I sent it to him, a story with pictures. A month or two later, I get a letter back with a check for $25.
What?
He bought the story. And that was the way it started for me. It was the official wrestling guide in the Big Book of Wrestling published by Tommy Kay, where he would pay me $25. And then my second story was about the feud between Chief J. Strongbow and Captain Lou Albano, also in that Big Book of Wrestling or wrestling guide. And then through Tom Burke, who worked at Ring Wrestling Magazine, I got to know Tom pretty well. And before you know it, I'm I'm taking pictures and writing stories for Ring Wrestling Magazine. And I actually got to work in the office at Ring Wrestling Magazine during the summer of 76. I'd gotten a summer job there, and it was basically filing pictures into the, you know, the vast amount of archives that they had. File cabinets of every wrestler imaginable. And of course, all the back issues were there for Ring. And it was with, you know, Nat Lobe. And I was there. I worked every day during the summer months at Ring Wrestling Magazine, making some money. And I started writing more and more and more. And then I was appointed contributing editor for Ring Wrestling Magazine. And then, you know, as I got to know Bill Apter, sitting at ringside, and started showing him some of my photos. And then I would not write for Apter, but he would buy pictures from me. So I had like the Russian chain match with Bruno Sammartino and Ivan Koloff at Boston Garden. He bought pictures from me. Mil Máscaras, when Dominic DiNucci and Victor Rivera won the tag team titles. I got a whole box here with all of my photos and magazines, everything that was published. And I also then I got a cover of a bloody superstar Billy Graham from Wrestling Review magazine, and an editor named Mark Thibodeau up in Canada when they were published up there. And I don't think I ever got paid for that. I got stiffed too. But anyway, that was kind of the way the journey went for me.
So this was a big night for you. This is a huge night.
It was. It started it. Yeah, it really did.
It wasn't just, hey, I'm close, I'm having fun. Now this is, you know, the next step into getting into the business.
Yes. How do I make money from it?
How do you make
money?
And let's look back at your first one for $25. Think back at, what was this, 1974? What was an hourly rate in 74? It had to be like $3, maybe? Something like
I
that.
I don't know. All I know is $25 was a lot of money for me.
A lot of money. That's a lot of money.
Even as a kid, you know.
That's a lot of money. I'm excited about this. That's cool. I've been waiting for that story for so long.
Yeah, and then I started selling my own pictures in an album, you know, because I'd be, especially when I got backstage and took pose shots of all these guys and the Valiant Brothers and Bruno and like everybody. And then I'd print up five, you know, go to the photo mat and get these pictures made up and then sell them to wrestling fans outside the Garden. Or we'd go to... typically have dinner before the Garden shows upstairs at the bowling alley with George Ann Macropoulos, Michael Mansky, Richie Marchand from Philly, and a bunch of hardcore fans from the Philly area. And every time I'd show up every month, they'd say, what do you got? You got new ones? And here they were. And I'm making 50 cents a pitcher or dollar a pitcher or whatever. So I'm like, you know, entrepreneurial, enterprising, and starting to make money in wrestling.
Oh, that's fantastic. I never knew that. Look at you. I was going to call you Elmer J. Arizzi there.
Yeah, I wish I had the pictures today. I wish I had those original prints that I sold, because those things are like, you know, $50 to $75 a pop now.
Because of the old
original
paper.
One.
Originally, yeah.
Yeah, because of the paper, because of the original print. And I see some of them. They're slabbed with a PSA authentication with my, because I used to write my name on the picture. You know, I'd put a little C, like a copyright John Arizzi. I'd write it in a little magic marker on it. They're out there still.
Oh, and so, okay. So if you don't know, PSA DSA is a grading service. They started the years ago doing sports cards. Baseball cards is very known for baseball cards. And it takes your card and it puts it in a see-through slab. And on the top of, they'll put a little slip on the top saying what it is. PSA DSA graded, Topps rookie card, Mickey Mantle, or whatever it may say. I don't know how long ago, maybe just a couple of years, they started doing photographs. So now you can give them photographs and they can tell you if this is a real photo, meaning...
Right. They put original photo.
Original photo.
Authentic original photo.
Yes. And they do that with like digital photos too. Like, I mean digital. Like if you went to the photo mat, they grade those too, saying they're original photos. So you may have the photo negative right now, or you have the digital copy, but now the valuable ones are the ones that John used to have.
I know.
And it has your name on it. You sign it, signed by the artist too. Have you seen somebody who has it slabbed? They call it slabbing.
Yes, I have. Yeah.
Is that crazy?
Yeah, it's crazy because I sold so many of them and I wish I had them. I wish I had them because I used to make, you know, 10 copies of each one and they'd all sell, but I wish I had them.
Yeah.
You know, I got the negatives, but it doesn't mean anything. If I had those original prints, oh my goodness. I'm trying to figure out a way, Timmy, to, you know, there's Leaf Trading Cards, right? That do a lot of wrestling stuff now.
Yep.
You know, I reached out to the guy. But he's never answered my emails yet, but I'm going to continue to try. Imagine getting a card. like a baseball card or whatever. But this has the original negative, and on the flip side is the print, or on the top of the card is the print or something. Imagine having that as a one of one by a card distributor.
Oh.
Negative print. I would say that that would be worth a little money for collectors.
No, it'd be worth a lot of money for collectors. Those one of ones. Those are those. Yeah, you couldn't.
Yeah, because it's only one negative. If you're, you know, have a picture of Andre the Giant against Ken Patera, for example. I know, you know, you're hot on that one.
I love that one.
Here's the card. Maybe it's a 5x7 instead of a, like a three, you know, a 2x2, whatever it is, like a baseball card. Maybe it's that, and it's the original negative. And of course, what the negative shows.
I've seen negatives like this before, and it's not what you do. It's a little something different. Disney does them with some things. They don't show the whole thing. So basically, the card
transparencies
is a transparency. Call it, right? So you would but taking what you want to do is you would make it like a 5x7 card, and on the bottom will be the negative that's transparent, so you can hold it up to the light and see the negative, and then look
or there's a white background
or a white background or something like
so
that.
So you could see that it's the actual negative.
Exactly.
Or a color slide. I used to have a lot of color slides. I don't have as many as I had wish I did, but that, I do have color slides.
All right. So if you're listening out there and you're an entrepreneur.
Yeah, if you're from Leaf.
Yeah, get Leaf on the phone. Somebody get Leaf on the phone. But this is like, wow. That's I never even thought about doing something like that. So you're selling individual one-of-a-kind negatives to make individual one-of-one cards. That's great.
Yes.
I love it. I love it.
I have thousands of negatives, man.
Let's do it. Let's get going. I love it. Let's
do it.
We get off track so much sometimes. We always get off track so much. So.
It's okay. I mean, because when we cover the card, what is it really? It's about 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's about 10 minutes,
it's
about three matches. Yeah.
Unless it's like Bruno winning the title or something really special.
Yeah, which we'll talk about next time. Yeah.
This card was a snoozer, with the exception of a couple of matches. So let's get it.
Actually, just a couple of matches. But if you do know anybody in the sports card business, this is something that John wants to work on. And he has so many negatives. So he doesn't know what to do with them. What a great idea.
Look what's up on Facebook and on Instagram. Look at those pictures that I'm putting up there.
Yeah.
Those are freaking great pictures.
Where can you find them on like eBay or where can people find any of your stuff? Let's give that a plug.
Right now, it's kind of like I've been putting all these vintage photographs up on my socials to drive up fan engagement, which obviously it's there. I mean, at 2 million impressions on my Matt Memory public Facebook page last month. I mean, people dig these things. Some of them get like 4,000 likes. And so I put these things out, and people keep saying you should do a coffee table book. You should do a book. You should do a book. There's no profit in books. There really isn't.
Yeah.
We have a limited audience here.
You know, it's so funny. I remember George Napolitano's books. Remember, he used to do those books, and every page would be a wrestler. What those are so great for is not as much even reading them, but getting them autographed. And I have one of his books signed by so many wrestlers.
Yes.
Oh, did I ever tell you? I think I told you that. I don't know if we mentioned on the show. Just to get off track again, because that's where we usually stay on this show. UWF, one of their first shows, I was there. Richie was there. I had George's book. I know that. We were in like a lobby or something. We had just seen you. You were working the show, going back and forth or something. I think I got, you know, some of the wrestlers were in the lobby, so I think I got a couple of them, and I saw George. And I said, hey, would you sign this for me? And he says, oh, you brought my book. And he was so, George, always a nice guy. He was like, oh, can I borrow this for a second? And I go, yeah. And he walked away with my book. Now I see other wrestlers coming by. I'm like, George got my book. What happened? And he comes back, and he had two signatures in it for me. One of them was a Cheetah Kid, and the other one was one of the Samoans. I think it was off of the Samoan. So cool. And that night, I never got Steve Williams to sign it, but I did get Terry Gordy to sign it in an elevator. The book is full of autographs now from all your shows.
Like the WWE does those encyclopedias now.
Yeah.
And people just go to all these conventions to get them signed. Unfortunately, for a Matt Memories book from the 70s, pictures of the 70s, everyone's dead.
Pretty much.
Tony Gurria is still with us.
Tony Gurria, you know, Bob Backlund.
Yeah, there's a handful. Everyone is gone.
Yeah.
So it's like if you put a coffee table book out with the intention of getting it signed, there's nobody left.
There's very, very, very few. Very few.
And that's sad, but it's the reality.
Oh, it's been reality. A few years. It's been a few years.
Over 50.
50. Really? Has it been that long? Has it been 50 years? Well, let's go back into the show. This one is back on HBO, and
I can't believe I'm still alive.
You are still, and you're still going strong too, doing those power walks, doing those power walks in Tennessee. This one's back on HBO, including Vince McMahon as commentary. So let's go to the first matches since and they're, you know, again, we're talking some long matches here that really don't need to be long. They don't need to be long,
right.
But they're long for, I guess we were talking earlier about HBO being there, and HBO probably said to them, you know, how long did the card usually run? Like 2 hours, John, roughly?
2.5 hours, 8:30 to 11.
So if you say to them, you know, it's got to be 2.5 hours. And then when you're talking television, that's hard time. When you're talking a house show, it could be on and off. It doesn't have to be exact, you know?
Right.
But a house show that is on HBO goes, I need it for this exact amount of time. And that's what you got to give them. So you got to make sure this is a long match. If Pedro's going to do a shorter match, this was going to be a longer match, and it may you rather see the Pedro match longer, but then you get this match. Match number one, Jose Gonzalez defeated El Olimpico in 15 minutes, 22 seconds.
Yes, Gonzalez versus Olimpico. I think it was Gonzalez's second time there, and of course, he's so notorious. He made his debut in 66. He retired in 2022, but known for the event that took place on July 16th, 1988, when he fatally stabbed Frank Goodish, Bruiser Brody.
Can we just do something for now? From right now, you know, when we mention this guy's name, I know you hate him. I hate him. The murderer, Jose Gonzalez. What's always the word they use? Allege. Allege?
Alleged.
The alleged murderer.
The alleged killer of Bruiser Brody.
Yeah, the alleged killer, Jose Gonzalez, defeated El Olimpico in 15 minutes, 20 seconds. I feel better now. Yeah. Continue.
Anyway, I mean, it happened in Puerto Rico, as most fans listening to this know, in San Juan. Gonzalez asked Brody to step into the shower. They were discussing business. There was a money issue that was festering for a while. There was an argument between the two. And, of course, this has been covered on Dark Side of the Ring and other places. Scuffle ensued, and Brody was stabbed in the shower. Tony Atlas ran into the shower, saw Brody bent over, holding his stomach. Atlas saw Gonzalez with the bloody knife. You know, there's so much that went on there. I mean, the wrestlers were obviously afraid for their lives. No one was snitching, calling the cops, and the cops did get a complaint, came into the locker room, and they thought it was a wrestling angle or whatever happened. But anyway, that's the story of Gonzalez. He was acquitted, claiming self-defense in 1989. Brody and Gonzalez wrestled each other in the 70s. I got pictures of the night Brody beat the crap out of Gonzalez. I mean, roughed him up really bad, bloodied him up at a TV taping in Philadelphia. And I got three or four shots of that match, and Gonzalez was just out of it. So he had vowed to others that he was going to get Brody back for that beating that took place. And then there was other things. Obviously, there was no love lost between them, and it came to a head, and that's what happened. But anyway, we digress, and screw Jose Gonzalez.
Screw him. Let's go to match number two. Dick Slater, Dick the Rebel Slater, as I like to call him. Dick Slater defeated Mike Pappas in 6 minutes, 20 seconds.
Yeah, Slater making his debut, and his real name was Richard Van Slater. He debuted in 72. He retired in 1996, trained by Eddie Graham and Hiro Matsuda. Slater went to high school with Eddie Graham's son, Mike, and he was in the business for less than a year when he made his Garden debut. So very close with Eddie Graham. Graham had influence, and Slater got the shot at the Garden. Years later, in 86, he returned to the WWF with a Southern Rebel gimmick, and in June of 2004, Slater was convicted for the stabbing of his girlfriend. He was sentenced to 1 year of house arrest, 2 years probation. Slater blamed the incident on influence from his addiction to painkillers. And in October 2018, Slater died due to heart complications at the age of 67.
I want to go back here real quick to Dick Slater. And you were saying that he was trained by Eddie Graham. Slater went to high school with Eddie Graham's son, Mike. So what are we talking here? Eddie Graham, pretty smart guy. What is he? I know of three high school wrestlers that he turned into professional wrestlers. His son, Mike, Steve Kern, and then Dick Slater. So that's three. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and he had the influence on so many others. I mean, Eddie was legit. He was a great wrestler. He's a great booker, promoter. He had his demons as well. And of course, unfortunately killed himself. Yeah, so anyway, tragic story with the Grahams. And he was with Dr. Jerry Graham, and there was you know, part of the Graham brothers' legacy back from even the 60s, Dr. Jerry Graham and his brother, Eddie.
Eddie Graham had such a mind for the business, such a mind for the business. Really smart man. And being able to look at three kids that weren't in the industry whatsoever, and he had the mind to know that these kids could protect the business.
Yeah, and there's probably so many others as well, but what a legacy left, and what a sad situation of the tragedies that the Graham family had. It's just really one of those dark stories of wrestling.
Absolutely.
And then Mike Pappas also was the opponent. I always liked Mike. I mean, I really did. He was really small, very compact, but very agile, a great flyer, great drop kicks. And his real name was Manoli Savanis. And there was a documentary called The Flying Greek. It's on YouTube, narrated by Medusa. And he was told by the WWF offices that he was too small and that Mexico would be better fit for him. He did eventually make a name for himself in Mexico and got his first break in the States in the Tennessee Territory and was given the name Mike Pappas.
Very nice. Let's go to match number three. And this is where I think, you know, you're talking about, we're talking HBO. And they do something like this, and I've got a question about this. Match number three, Iron Mike McCord fought Manuel Soto to a 20-minute draw. Now, I understand you have to go long for HBO, but couldn't you like go have a pin at like 19:30 or something? Because nobody really cares. No one's really interested in one-loss records of these guys, but you go 20 minutes, and then you give them a draw? What do you? I don't like
you
it.
Really hate the you hate those 20-minute draws. I mean, we've gone over so many shows where you this just kind of irks you.
Well,
but it was part of the deal. It was like you have a 2.5-hour show. You know, you have a certain amount of time that's allocated. These were fillers. This was a filler. I mean, the fans were there. They're a captive audience. There's nothing they can do about it. HBO, you know, if it's live, there's nothing they can do about it either. But this is the way it was. McCord and Soto, 20-minute draw. Do we wish we could change it? Yes, we can. That's it. They did it every freaking show. There was always a couple of snoozers that just were long and seemed dragged out. And that's where you'd go get your popcorn or get a hot dog or, you know, or start talking to some of your friends and not watching the show.
But, okay, first of all, you can't do that anymore because you're in the second row. They can see you. But then you talk about the next match, which is match number four. Dean Ho defeated Pancho Valdez in 18 minutes, 45 seconds. So he beat him in 18 minutes. Why make everyone go through a 20-minute match for nothing for two guys that no one really cares about? That's
right. If you take a look at those matches there, you had you really had out of a 2.5-hour show, you had almost 40 minutes of just two matches.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah. And you're like, well, why? Why? What are we doing here? Because
and you wonder why we digress, and you know, this is what we do.
Yeah.
On the show, we reminisce, we talk history, and when it comes down to the matches, you have matches like this where you know they were part of the show. You got to talk about them.
You know what I used to love
filler.
About it is filler. I used to love going to the Garden, and you have your opening match, and it goes long, and everyone, you know, you feel the match going too long, you feel it in your bones. And then when finally someone gets pinned, everyone erupts. Yeah. And the wrestler's like, you're looking up at he's holding his arm up. He's all excited because everyone's cheering for him. They're not cheering for you because you had a great match. They're cheering for you because the match is over.
Yes.
Not the best feeling.
Totally.
Yeah. I used to
hear that bell ring. All right. Next.
Next.
Everyone's there to see the main events. Everyone's there to see the attractions. And these were fillers.
Exactly. So now we're going to go to a main event. Match number five, WWF World Champion Pedro Morales defeated Larry Henning in 12 minutes, 45 seconds when the match was stopped because of blood.
Yeah, it was a brawl, and there was some color, as they called it, with Henning. Henning was a good brawler. This was an exciting match. It was even more exciting for me because I was sitting right up close. It was fun to watch. Of course, Henning, what a legacy he had. He's also the father of Mr. Perfect Kurt Henning. Henning made his debut in 1956. He retired in 1985. He was trained by Vern Gagne. And one thing I remember most about Henning, he was a teammate and tag team champion with Harley Race. So they had a pretty historic tag team in the AWA territories. Following his retirement from wrestling, he and his wife became owners of a real estate company in St. Cloud, Minnesota. In December of 2018, Henning died from kidney failure at the age of 82. And as we all know, what a tragedy when his son Kurt passed away on February 10th, 2003, from acute cocaine intoxication at the young age of 44. Morales, on the other side of the coin, I mean, and this was his last title defense at Madison Square Garden before losing it 18 days later on December 1st against Stan the Man Stasiak. So this was kind of his last soiree as the champion there. Stasiak, of course, would only hold the title for 9 days, and Pedro held the title for 1,027 days, which I guess Roman Reigns might have surpassed him by now, even though Roman Reigns only wrestles once every 2 or 3 months. Anyway, I digress. From the Scott Teal book, Wrestling from the Garden, this is what makes Captain Lowell Albano one of the greats, because Morales was doing a pre-show promo in Spanish, and then Albano walked on camera, and in a kayfabe shoot, if you want to call it that, said he could understand Spanish, and he would translate what Pedro was saying for all the English-speaking viewers, because Pedro always did an interview, and McMahon would say, and Pedro, why don't you tell something to all your Puerto Rican fans? And Morales would say that. So Albano walks on set, and when Pedro started talking, Albano, he interfered, and he was like, I want all your greasy little blank Puerto Ricans to come to Madison Square Garden this Monday night. And so he was doing that, and he did. Albano predicted that it would be his last match. And ironically, 18 days later in Philly, Morales did lose that title. So maybe there was a little swerve there for the fans. Nowadays, of course, on TV, you could never, ever say anything that was mentioned like the heels used to do on those promos. I mean, the disparaging racist comments that used to come out of their mouths, Blassie, Albano, the Grand Wizard, all the heels. I mean, you could never get away with any of that stuff now. Sometimes when I listen back to the vintage WWF promos that I have that I do put up for patrons from the years of 75, 76, 77, I get flabbergasted. Back then, you know, the world has changed so much, but it did bring some heat with the Morales fans against, you know, Albano. They didn't like him. And Hennig, you know, being part of that, he just had the overspill of the hatred of the Puerto Rican fans.
I know Richie and I are really, Richie's putting together something for our next show, talking a lot about Pedro, because he's not going to have the title next time. Just how big a draw he was at the Garden. He was huge at the Garden, and anything you can do to get those fans a little more riled up. And Captain Lou Albano was one of the best in the business. You come into the ring with somebody that no one's seen before. Not a lot of people know who this guy is. And in 1 month of promos, you can do enough damage to have people buy a ticket and sit in a seat, watch your guy wrestle your hero.
Maybe because the advance was so small, maybe they decided to pull that off just to see if it would rile up the fans and motivate them to buy a ticket. Because it was a very small house.
You never know.
Speculation.
Speculation. That's what we do the best in the show. A little speculation going on there. Match number six. One of the guys that I'm really starting to like, Don Leo Jonathan, defeated Tony Garea in 18 minutes, 45 seconds.
Yeah, they were obviously planning another title match with Jonathan as challenger, because he was Bruno's first title defense at the Garden back in January of 74. So they were lifting him up again. And Jonathan was one of my all-time favorite wrestlers, always was, and could never understand why he didn't get the title himself. But him defeating Garea, which was a big step, because Garea was beloved and he was, you know, a solid performer, tag team champion, all of that, one of the favorite baby faces of the era. So having Jonathan go over him clean at 1845, that was just kind of a strategy on their part, as they wanted to lift Jonathan up before they gave him the first title shot against Bruno.
Match number seven, Vern Gagne defeated WWF Tag Team Champion Mr. Fuji in 12 minutes, 16 seconds. Vern uses a sleeper hold to win the match. I would like to see Vern putting Mr. Fuji in a sleeper hold. That would be entertaining.
Yeah, Mr. Fuji, of course, went out like a light pretty quickly. And I did bring my 8mm camera to this show. Not a lot of rolls. I think I only brought 2 rolls of film, and I did film some of that match, Gagne against Mr. Fuji. But for me, I was always in awe of Gagne just because of who he was, how much I read about him in the magazines, and the fact that he was a world champion appearing at the Garden, other than the WWF champ.
You know, you talked about it earlier, how important the magazines were. I just didn't know how many magazines there were, and why didn't John go to his local store and get them? Well, they weren't available at his local store. Not all of them. New York City, when you're in New York City back in the day, and you go to a newsstand, they'd have newspapers from all over the country. They'd have magazines from all over the country. You get stuff there that you couldn't get anywhere else. And that's what you did. You had your big bag of magazines of the month.
Yes, and I'd read them religiously. I mean, and that's how I really got to be enamored with Vern Gagne and Dory Funk. All the magazines had ratings. When I first started reading the wrestling magazines, it was like, all right, WWF champion. And then you would see AWA champion. And I'm like, what's the AWA?
Yeah, you never seen the
show. Then you realize that there was other wrestling outside of what you watched on TV. But Gagne for me was interesting. I mean, Richie, of course, with his research, always does a wonderful job. Gagne was born Laverne Clarence Gagne. He died at age of 89 in 2015. He was, of course, well-known, and the reason I guess he was AWA champion so many times and for such a long period of time because he was the AWA owner of the Federation, and he debuted in 1949, retired in 1981. He was an alternate for the U.S. freestyle wrestling team in the 1948 Olympics. He served 2 years in the U.S. Marines from 44 to 46. He was actually drafted in the 16th round by the NFL Chicago Bears in the 47 draft, and in 1960, he formed the American Wrestling Alliance. Later, it became the American Wrestling Association. And in 1991, the AWA shut down after 30 years, and he ended up in bankruptcy court. They made him a member of the WWE Hall of Fame in 2006.
What a great career. And always overshadowed. Everyone else, you know, they talk about who was in there, and Hogan was there at one time and other people. This was back in the day when, like, wrestlers were wrestlers.
Yes. You
know? He could really hold his own.
He could. He was a good shooter.
Very good shooter. Him and Lou Thesz. Match number 8. And this is, I would really think, John, this is why I would go to the match, just to see one of these guys wrestle. Match number 8, Chief J Strongbow and the 8th Wonder of the World, Andre the Giant. I'd love to see Andre. Defeated Blackjack Lanza and Stan Stasiak in a best of 2 out of 3 falls. 2 falls, 2-0.
Yeah, I remember it vividly because it's one of my favorite 8mm films that I shot back then. And I have a fabulous amount of that match on film. It was just wonderful always seeing Andre the Giant and seeing him on close up, and him and Strongbow had this great synergy as a tag team, two of the most popular performers at the time, and defeating two rough guys. I mean, Blackjack Lanza and soon to be the WWF champion Stan Stasiak. So it was a great way to end the show. It was great seeing that match and having it on film to boot.
I'm gonna ask you, but I probably already know, how would you rate this card?
2 thumbs up just because of where I sat.
Exactly.
That was it. Nothing else but the location. 5 stars.
5 stars. Okay. We'll let it stand on that. You got some great wrestlers coming in there, and you got Vern Gagne in there. You got a little Pedro in there. But the main thing is seeing Andre wrestle again, which I never got to see, and I regret never getting to see Andre, especially in his prime. I can just imagine at the end of the second fall, it was always Chief J Strongbow jumping into Andre's arms and Andre holding him up like a little baby. I always thought that was pretty cool.
I have so many shots of that. Of them.
Legendary.
Because they did it all the time.
All the time. It was like their thing. It was their thing. Our next Garden Show, December 10th, 1973. Headlining our next show, the WWF Heavyweight Champion Stan Stasiak taking on challenger Bruno Sammartino, which just sounds really awesome. Also on the card, a return match with Pedro Morales versus Larry Henning in a lumberjack death match. What is that going to look like? I have no idea, because they changed the matches in the WWF. So, John, I'm looking forward to finding out what exactly is a WWF lumberjack match, and also seeing our first and last appearance of Stan Stasiak wearing the heavyweight championship.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lumberjack match, which was really wrestlers around the ring. And this will be such a memorable, it's one of the most memorable shows I ever went to this day, because Bruno Sammartino comes back, wins the WWF title from Stan Stasiak. What a celebration at the Garden that night. I can't wait to review it. But also, John, the Golden Greek Tolis, makes his return to Madison Square Garden after many, many years, and he takes on Victor Rivera. It was one of the most memorable Garden shows I ever went to, and I can't wait to review it with everybody and yourself, Tim. And we will probably have a special guest, like Harry Silken I reached out to him, and he has graciously agreed to come on to review that card with us.
I was just going to tell you a second ago, should we say that? Spoiler alert, Bruno wins a title. Yeah, it has been 50 years, so it's really not a spoiler alert anymore.
Right. No reason for a spoiler on that one, my
friend.
It's
50 years ago. I think enough time has passed.
I think people know it's going to happen.
I'm looking forward to hearing you and Kerry talking about being at that match and what it was like being in the arena on that night. The changing hands of a title is always amazing, but this is one, this is a special one. It's not just any title changing, it's the heavyweight championship title, and it's going back to Bruno, where you thought all along it belonged.
That is correct. I couldn't wait. Once I found out that that was going down, man, I was excited. And we had a party, and I'll tell you about that party on the next episode, but we actually had a party before the show, before it even happened, at the bar at Madison Square Garden in the bowling alley, because we all knew Bruno was back, and he was going to be world champion once again.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. Once again, we want to do a shout out to Scott Teal and Crowbar Press. He wrote our Bible. We talk about this all the time. When we talk to you and, you know, you're hearing about the match and you remember it and you look at your pictures, but if we didn't have this book, I don't know what we'd do.
It's the Bible. It really is. Wrestling in the Garden, The Battle for New York, Work, Shoots, and Double Crosses, only available from Scott Teal and Crowbar Press Books. Go to crowbarpress.com and get your copy of it. You'll love it.
All right. Anything else, John?
That's it, my friend.
Our next show is December. We'll see you then. For John Arizzi and Rich Garcia, I'm Tim Poutre. We'll see you next time.